Radio Free Alaska. Right, good afternoon and welcome to Radio Free Alaska, broadcasting freedom in an unfree world. Today is February 10th, 2023. Today we're going to begin on Folklore Friday, the reading of the novel Tusk. Tusk begins in memory of Chuck Lyons, Bill Twitty, Brian Kellogg, Brian Carr, Michael Corbet, David Robertson, Louis Elizondo, Vinnie Elizondo, Adrian Elizondo, Cheryl Iverson, Louise Elizabeth Pigeon, Edward Rodney Pigeon, Ricky Michaels, Thomas Hadnot, Murray Ingersoll, Harley Roberts, Chucky Roberts, Teresa Miller, Howard Pizik. I remember. Part one, Ella G. Kayotov. Chapter one. It was the summer of 1957. The hot California sun was blazing down on the car, driving the heat off the metal, as Roger Jenkins rubbed another coat of turtle wax on his yellow 1957 Plymouth Fury, taking particular care to buff the fins spoiling over the trunk. It was a look, he thought, like that new F-102 fighter jet that was now flying out of San Francisco. That real swept-back look. Plymouth really outdid Chevy on this one, putting the fins way up in the air rather than that subtle thing on the Bel Air. This one is going to be a collector, he thought. Dealing with a hot summer day in the Sacramento Valley was a problem even for the seasoned Californian, particularly in August when the temperature would get up around 105 degrees and the humidity would get up around 150%. Well, it sure felt like 150%. Your t-shirt would stick to your back and you regretted having worn long pants, but you couldn't get into shorts until you got off work. Today wasn't that day, however, no. Today was a Sunday, a day made up of watching a Giants game to see Willie Mays knock it out of Candlestick one more time, drinking a little Schlitz beer and tinkering with the car. Roger kept a can opener on a chain connected to his fuzzy dice hanging from the rearview mirror in case he needed to open one for the road. Yeah, it was true he would occasionally drink a few too many, but that habit had backed off once Gibbons died in the bad wreck over on Highway 20. Some say he swerved. Others say it was chicken. Either way, his 49 Ford didn't fare well against that 56 DeSoto wagon. He went straight through the windshield. Gibbons had a few too many. In fact, he had a few too many at the Samoa Club with Roger. Roger went home. Gibbons headed for the coast. One lived, one didn't. Anyway, Roger settled down a little bit after his stint in Korea. He did 2 years there, serving with the platoon that had taken Porkchop Hill twice. He didn't much like talking about that particular war. Well, conflict. At least that was how it was supposed to be called now, according to Huntley Brinkley on NBC. It didn't feel like a conflict when he was there. It felt a lot more like a war. Every now and then he would talk with his friends, friends like Gibbons, about the last bonsai charge from the North Koreans, where they were killing 50 to 60 guys at a time. The barrel of the 50 caliber literally bent from the heat. Air support finally got them out of there. Of course, it wasn't an F-102. It was the old P-80, the Sabre jet, they called it. It pretty well matched the Russian MiG-17, or maybe the MiG matched the Sabre jet. Either way, they looked alike. When he shipped back home and landed in San Francisco, he found himself in an uncongenial and hostile place. It seemed to him that there were lots of people interested in fist fighting in that town, but usually the fights were not only fists, but included brass knuckles and blackjacks. One of those was about all a guy could take. One of those was about all a guy would ever want to take. Finally, the night before he was set to pack it up and head for Davis, a little town in the Sacramento Valley, he stopped by Luigi's for a couple of beers. Luigi's was a long, narrow pub down on Fisherman's Wharf. It was roomy enough to accommodate a long bar with stools and enough room behind the stools to allow a gent an easy stroll to the bathroom in the back. Waiting for you at the front door, however, was the foulest-mouthed minor bird you'd ever heard, calling you every name in the book as soon as you walked in. The bird was there to set the ambiance. However, Roger got to drinking, and then he got to talking, and then he got to exaggerating, and then he got to name-calling, and then he got to fighting, in that order. But like they say, a fist fight in San Francisco in those days included a little more than fists, and sure enough, he took one right behind the ear from a leather-covered blackjack. He didn't know what hit him. The fellow that hit him, though, thought it was quite funny to load his limp and unconscious body onto a freight train car headed for Chicago. Roger didn't wake up until the rail yard boss in Reno splashed a little cold water in his face and demanded to know his name. Now, it looked like Roger was about to be arrested. They hauled him off the freight car and took him to the department. But Roger was sporting some kind of a shiner and a big knot on the back of his head. When the rail boss saw the lump, he just jeered his thumb and said, "Get him out of here." They moved Roger to the other side of the tracks and left him there with a swollen noggin, a screaming headache, and a disorientation to all things up and down, to suffer alone in a place he couldn't recognize. Of course, Roger's first move was to reach for his wallet. It was long gone, together with all the cash he had, which wasn't much. He seemed to remember 26 bucks, but then again, it might have been less, given that 26 bucks was the number he had when he went into Luigi's before he'd had his first beer. At 50 cents each, and maybe he'd bought a round or two, well, who knows how much money he had left. Either way, he didn't know where he was, and he had no idea how he was going to get to where he was going, or for that matter, what he was going to do when he got there. It didn't take long for him to figure out he was in Reno. He stepped out onto Virginia Street and immediately recognized the place. How could he forget? He lost 300 bucks here 6 years ago. Anyway, he worked his way up to 4th Street and reckoned a westerly direction and put out his thumb. It wasn't long until an old codger in a split windshield 51 Chevy truck picked him up. "Where are you headed?" he asked. "Sacramento, if you got room," Roger attempted to pick up a full ride offer. "Oh, I got room all right," the old man jawed. "But I'm only heading as far as Truckee. Will that work for you?" "Well, now, what can you say, especially when you're already in the truck and he's already moving?" So Roger went along for the ride up to Truckee, about 30 miles, right on up into the Sierras. Come about 6:30, the old man put him out at the corner of Donner Pass Road and Highway 89. There wasn't much there, not much at all. And there hadn't been any dinner. The sun was starting to set and the chill was setting in, One of those cool mountain evenings when it drops into the 40s with a little bit of breeze. Roger looked around and couldn't find much but an old roll of butcher paper, something you wrap fish or meat in. It didn't take him long to figure out that this was all he was going to get. So he wrapped himself up in it like a fish, rolling around until he had several layers, and believe it or not, it kept him warm the entire night. Come the morning and looking even worse for wear, Roger headed back onto the highway and put out his thumb. He was getting really hungry now, and he could hear his stomach growl. As he walked along, he caught something out of the corner of his eye, something shining in the weeds. He went over and looked, and glory be if it wasn't an unopened can of Schlitz beer. Sure, it was looking a little tired, and it had an inordinate amount of stuff sticking to it. But if he could get it open, well, it might as well be steak and eggs. He struggled with all kinds of things, sharp rocks, sticks, and so on, until he found an old 2x4 with a rusty 16-penny nail sticking up on one end. You know, the kind of nail you'd never want to step on? He took that nail and drove two holes into the top of the beer can, one to drink and one to vent the can so the contents would come out. Surprisingly enough, there was still a little carbonation and the beer tasted like heaven. After breakfast, Roger headed back out on the road and flew the thumb. It took several hours, but a young guy in a 55 Ford pulled over. Roger got in and noticed that the driver had an Elvis Presley look going on. Lots and lots of Brill Cream, glossing a mop of black hair up over the top of his zit-covered forehead into a full bouffant, complete with loads of dripping grease. The Ford had a few problems as well. The right front headlight was caved in. There was a long-running dent down the right side. The rearview mirror was also missing. The engine was running pretty well, but the smoke coming out of the tail was a little blue. Roger climbed into the cab, accompanied with the squeal of tires. Roger didn't say much, at least until this driver started to talk about playing chicken, particularly on hills and around curves. To demonstrate, he intentionally passed a car on a hill and stayed in the oncoming lane until the oncoming car screeched and swerved for the ditch. The greaser just laughed, lit another cigarette. When he cleared another hill, the pedal went to the floor, and that was that. Roger watched the speedometer climb, and after it passed 85, Roger started getting reflexive. He looked down the road and could see the blinking lights of the rail crossing starting to flash, now less than a mile. He looked over and saw the freight train closing. The pedal stayed fixed to the floor, and the driver held the smirk and the cigarette with the same lips. When they reached 100 yards and 100 miles per hour, you could reach no conclusion other than that a collision with a freight train was about to occur. Roger tapped the greaser on the shoulder, and the guy actually turned to look at him. Roger got right in his face and screamed at the top of his lungs, "Lock 'em!" And the greaser, without ever looking back at the road, dropped both feet hard on the brakes, locking all four wheels and putting the Ford into a slowly rotating, screeching tire, 180-degree spin. The car came to a stop approximately 3 feet from the train, which was rumbling by. And as soon as it stopped, Roger stepped out, tipped his hat, and walked away, noticing tire marks that were over 200 feet long. The train cleared crossing, and the Ford took off, leaving Roger on the highway again with his thumb out, which is how he met his future wife, Ella G. Now, Miss Ella G was a scrawny thing, only 17 years old at the time, with a contemporary hairdo that didn't work on her, wearing contemporary fashion that didn't work on her, and driving a 51 Volkswagen Beetle that didn't work on her. She looked like she fit better on an Oklahoma farm than in California, but she was certainly friendly, if not shy. She was trusting and naive, and all of Roger's lines worked on her. He was so successful that in a mere 2 weeks, she was saying, "I do," in front of a justice of the peace up in Reno, and the marriage was on. By October, the rabbit died, so to speak, and Roger and Ella G had decided on names. If it was going to be a boy, then his name would be Riley Thomas, RT for short. And if it was a girl, they were going to name her Roberta Sparks, after the town of the same name, but they would call her Sparky. They had found a little converted garage rental in Roseville that wasn't much, but it did have this little stand of white picket fence around the front and a splotch of green grass where the driveway used to be. Roger got hired by a guy who respected veterans to work on his farm, and Roger scraped up enough money to get some financing to buy that brand new bright yellow 57 Plymouth. All was good until Roger lost his job following that business with Gibbons and needed to find something else. Roger tried a lot of stuff talking to the guys at the Samoa Club. All they could say was that he should try his hand logging in the redwoods, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. In the meantime, he started bussing tables at the Gold Panners Club in Sacramento to keep some cash coming in. They'd already sold VW, and the beloved Plymouth was next on the block. Now one day, this flamboyant guy all dressed in black came into the Gold Panner wearing a full cowboy getup, including the John Wayne bandana around his neck. He was wearing this enormous black Stetson, black clothes, a black leather vest with small silver coins stitched in buttons, and shiny black cowboy boots with gold-plated spurs. At least they looked gold-plated, but they were probably brass. He started flashing around silver dollars and even some gold nuggets while he drank, and he drank nothing but whiskey. "Well, sir," Roger put on a little Tex accent, "ain't you looking mighty fancy for a place like this?" "What's it to you, Flatlander?" The artisan took another shot of whiskey. "Well, people dress a little differently around here now that we won WW2, Roger intoned. "Is that right, Flatlander?" The artisan looked up. "Did you have anything to do with that?" "Well, I was too young for WW2, but I sure had my hands full. Well, where I come from, we had Japanese troops on soil and had to slug it out in some of the roughest terrain and rottenest weather on earth." The artisan didn't even look at Roger for that one. "What are you talking about?" Roger asked. "There weren't any Japanese troops on U.S. soil." "There sure were." "You are full of it," Roger turned to walk away. And with that, he heard the cock of a derringer and the cold steel behind his ear, the same ear that had the blackjack over it the very year before. The area had some nerve damage, but the nerves seemed to be very hypersensitive now. Roger froze. The stranger said quietly, "Nobody calls me a liar." "Now, you ain't calling me a liar, are you?" Roger responded in a chill. No, sir. I was just having a little trouble with your story." He heard the derringer uncock and a laugh. "Well, you ever heard of the Aleutian Islands?" he asked. "Can't say as I have," Roger said, wiping off the table and attempting to pick up the empty whiskey glass. The stranger stayed his hand and motioned the bartender further. "Well, you should look into it," the stranger said. "In fact, if you have half a mind, I'd take you back there and show you myself." "Well, where is this Aleutian Island?" Roger asked. "It's not an island. It's a bunch of islands." The stranger pulled out a gold nugget about the size of a strawberry. "Same place I got my story," the stranger mused. He turned and looked Roger right in the eye. "Look, if you're interested in this kind of stuff, I can use another laboring hand at Port of Seward. I don't know what you're making here, but I'll pay you 20 a week in gold like I do everyone else. I'll pay your expenses to get there, but if you don't stay for 2 years, you'll have to pay me back. And don't think about skipping out on me. That's what I'm doing here now, finding this hide and retrieving my loan." Roger reflected on the $28 a month he was making bussing tables at the Gold Panners. He and Ella G were barely eating, and with her being almost 7 months pregnant, well, there weren't a lot of options other than spending down the Plymouth. "Where is this place you're talking about?" Roger asked him. "Alaska," said the stranger, and he finished the shot of whiskey with one gulp, slammed the shot glass down on its head, and got up to leave. Chapter 2. Ella G was having a horrible pregnancy, something about the positive-negative blood thing between her and the baby. One thing about those Reno marriages, there wasn't anything between your decision and your "I do." Ella G thought to herself many times that she would have been better off saying "I don't," but she couldn't tell Roger that now. She'd be all alone with no money and now with no car and a newborn. She knew in her own heart that running off wasn't going to work out. It wasn't like there were a lot of other men searching her out. She couldn't go back to her parents. She wasn't going back to Mississippi for anything. Besides, if she ever got the chance, her old man would be dead after all of that. She'd kill him herself and burn the whole house down. So now here she was, stuck and 7 months pregnant, sick as a dog and fat as a cow. Her career as a waitress was over, And Tony wouldn't ever take her back. The things he said about her, she would never go back there anyway. Well, it didn't make much of a difference, no. She got out of Mississippi, and she knew she would get out of this as well. She had a saying that she said to herself when things were getting bad. You keep rolling with it until you roll up on top. She kept that in mind. She rambled through the fridge. Of course, every time she pulled the handle on the Frigidaire, she remembered that five-year-old who climbed into the one that some fool had left in the junkyard. He closed the door and couldn't get out. They didn't find him for 3 days. And of course, that poor little boy, she held back the tears and clutched her stomach in cold fear. She choked for a minute, but composed herself and pulled open the door to find what was left of what little food they ever had. Three slices of bread, one slice of bologna with a stuffed olive in the middle of it, and about a teaspoon of Miracle Whip. There was a half box of powdered milk remaining and two potatoes, but the potatoes already had eyes. There was still a good chance that the electric company was going to give them that payment plan, which means that the electric would not be turned off tomorrow. Another hot, sweaty day in the valley was likely, with no chance of relief. Maybe go down to the municipal pool. Of course, at 7 months pregnant, that was not going to be looked upon favorably, particularly by that group of bitty bodies that ran the local Kiwanis Club. I mean, she thought, can't you just concentrate on selling those lousy cookies and mind your own business? She didn't go. It wasn't much longer before Roger came home smelling like beer. Wasn't any money, but that didn't stop the bar tab. Honey, I've got some news, he said while changing his clothes to his favorite wife beater t-shirt and a pair of old shorts. Elegy said nothing because nothing was what a church mouse said in these situations. You can start packing right now, Roger said as he attempted to rifle through the refrigerator. Packing? Are you getting rid of me? She asked on the verge of tears again. No, we're packing, he said with energy. We're going someplace new, someplace great. What are you talking about? LG asked calmly. I got a job offer, he said. Are we going to have to move? She asked. Have to? Have to? His tone was incredulous. No, we get to move. Well, where are we going? Could you do me the favor of telling me that much? LG was starting to show frustration. You're not going to believe it when I tell you, he hummed. LG sat back and groaned as she held her stomach. We're going to Alaska, he said. And with a second thought, he reached into the cupboard and found an old jar that had converted to a drinking glass. And he set the glass on its head on the table with a slam. And with that, Elegy's water broke. And Riley Thomas Jenkins was on his way into the world a month and a half early. Although it was only a couple of miles to Roseville Sutter Hospital, Roger made sure that he broke every speed limit between the house and the hospital because he could. Soon he had an escort. The police had initially pulled him over, but when they discovered that a baby was on the way, well, speeding became the order of the day, and off they both went. Notwithstanding the speeding, they still didn't make it into the delivery room. Instead, the doctor on call rushed out to the car to help deliver the baby in the back seat. Now, RT was only 5 pounds, 5 ounces, being born a bit early in the spring of April 1958, but other than size, he was perfectly healthy, a spunky baby with a loud voice and a quick temper. Ella G was never checked into the hospital. Roger asked her how she felt, and although she told him that she wasn't sure things were all right, he kept arguing with her about the hospital bill and how they had no money and so on. So he took off with Ella G before even the placenta delivered. So Ella G attempted to recover at home with no food and no support. It was like this for 3 days while Roger came in very late and left very early. She wondered how he could keep going on so little sleep. She, in the meantime, was sleeping enough for both of them, sometimes for 18 hours. Finally, on Friday, it wasn't just Roger who came home, but he brought a stranger with him. Ella G was still in bed, having not taken a shower since the birth of RT, and still wearing the ratty dress she had on when they took off for the hospital. That funky old red dress she wore to her junior prom. RT was in the bed and was nursing when they walked in. Nice place you've got here, said the stranger, glancing at Ella G and the baby. Yeah, thanks, said Roger. Look forward to getting out of here. The ship leaves out of San Francisco Sunday at 11 a.m. You and your family need to be on it. Roger looked at Ella G with a huge smile. Ella G just glared and got out of the bed, struggling to cover her otherwise exposed self with the blanket on the bed. Could you maybe introduce your friend and tell me what's going on? She asked. Oh, sure. This is Pat McKenzie, Roger stammered. Mackie, they call me. Nice to meet you, said McKenzie, addressing her in a similar manner as he would a horse. Right, Ella G got up, picked up the baby ever so carefully, worked her way between the two men toward the bathroom. McKenzie didn't bother to move as she pushed across the tiny room, and she eventually sidestepped him. She looked up at him with a glare. He sneered a smile back at her, his eyes following her hiked-up dress over her exposed backside into the bathroom. Roger, he asked, still staring at Ella G, are you going to be able to make the boat, yes or no? I will be on the boat, come hell or high water, said Roger. Don't say high water when you're heading to Alaska, McKenzie advised. Leave that out of the conversation. Look, McKenzie said, putting his hands into his pocket and pulling out some bills. Here's $200. The train is $7 each, and you can get it in San Francisco Saturday evening if you catch the noon train tomorrow. Here's another $20 for expenses in the meantime, and here's a $40 advance on wages. McKenzie pushed the remainder back into his pocket. Now get going. And with that, McKenzie said nothing more. He picked up his hat and walked out. Ella G eventually came out of the bathroom, having taken a shower while holding the baby in one arm and shifting the load to get one side clean and then the other. She wasn't in a pleasant mood, but she said nothing. Roger was throwing his clothes into their only suitcase, an old heavy blunt thing with massive clips on the front. He filled it quickly with his jeans and his boots. He left Ella G to carry her things and the baby's things in two pillowcases. They packed what they had and drove downtown to the Beacon Burger, a place they had hungered to visit for over a year now, but were not able to. Roger announced that he was selling his Plymouth for $1,500. Given that it only had 12 miles and was in perfect condition, he had a buyer before he left the restaurant. With that, they went shopping. He bought the heaviest winter coat he could find for him and for Ella G, and Ella G spent her time getting warm clothing for RT. They bought boots and sweaters and three more suitcases, and Ella G packed her winter gear into one case, and she packed her new dresses, stockings, and undergarments into the other. She threw the pillowcases into the garbage, and they gathered their things in preparation of leaving California for good. They caught a taxi cab, swung by their landlord's house to drop off the key, and headed for the hotel across the street from the train station. Everything was going very well as though it was planned. A good night's sleep, a nice big breakfast, and they would be on the train for San Francisco well ahead of the departure on the Juno Star, the ferry that will take them to Alaska. It was nothing but excitement now. So this is our read of Tusk today on Folklore Friday, Radio Free Alaska. I hope you guys are enjoying this because we're going to continue until we finish this story. Thank you for joining us. I want to say Shabbat Shalom to you as we enter into the weekend. And I want to encourage you to visit us on our Telegram channel, Radio Free Alaska. To also visit us at SeferAcademy.net and Sefer.net. All scriptural citations, although there won't be many in this text, will be taken from the Sefer Millennium. We want to thank you again, brothers and sisters, for joining us on Radio Free Alaska. Broadcasting freedom in an unfree world. We will see you next week.